to another hot episode of Hacker Public Radio. My name is Dan Washko, and I will be your guide today on another trip down the Linux boot process. Now, I believe we are at episode number 5 in this series, if I'm not mistaken, although I haven't numbered them as such. Let me double check here. Linux boot process. Yeah, no, am I mistaken? Technically, we're on episode number 5. There's been 5 episodes already, but I kind of split the Linux boot process bootloaders into 2 different episodes. So we're at kind of, all right, we'll just say part 6, for lack of better words. Part 6, today we're going to be talking about the init process. And to recap, what we have talked about so far was the difference between System 5 and BSD-style scripts. And this is where we're going to start seeing the big differences in those systems, as I iterated in the first overview of the Linux boot process on the first show, and talked about differences between System 5 and BSD-style scripts. Anyway, where we're at here is we have booted the system. It's gone through post. It's initialized the bootloader, be it Lilo or Grub. Now, it is either booted the kernel, or it's booted the kernel and the initializing RAM disk or RAM file system initialization. And we talked about those two, I think the last episode, was whether or not you need a RAM disk or an initializing RAM file system to enable you to get access to the root partition and begin the mother of all processes, the init script, or the init process. Init is the first process, and it's the one process to rule them all, essentially, at this point. So what the job of init is to create processes and manage them, and then initialize the shutdown process to kill those processes when it's time to close the system down. So the init process is a very major and very important process on the Linux system. Now, by default, most distributions run an init process and configure init by the file etc init tab. That's inittab by default. So when the kernel has been loaded and the root file system has been accessed, the init process is kicked off. Now, if you recall when I talked about kernel boot options, instead of it actually running the init process, which is the default, you can specify a different application or a different service to be run in place of init. For example, you can pass the parameter init equals /bin/bash, and that will run a bash shell instead of init, which means you're essentially going to get a single user bash session with nothing initialized, except for the defaults that bash initializes. You won't have your file systems mounted as you would expect them to be. You won't have a variable set up properly. Most of your devices probably might not be working. Your system daemons will not be working as you would expect. It's a very basic mode. It's useful for situations where you've screwed up your configuration or you need to repair your system, because essentially it is like Linux user, single user. But given that, you can set init to any application that you can run from the basic mounted root partition. Your results may vary. In the instance of repair, the bash instance, the bash application is great to run, but you're not going to want to run Firefox or something if you can access it out of, set that as your init, because it's not going to run. You're not going to be an X. You could really cobble together something to do that, but it would be ridiculous to set it to something like Firefox. In addition to that, I will make mention here of the fact that Ubuntu has begun replacing init with a system they called Upstart, which is, I'll cover that in a little bit, but Anyway, just so you know, that init is typically the first process that's going to run. Now, init can be run from an initrd or an init ram file system image. Basically, what that does is, again, like I talked about before, you have a very modular kernel. Chances are you might not have all the hardware modules built into your kernel to recognize your hardware and or file systems, which is where an init initializing RAM disk or initializing RAM file system come in handy, that it contains a little mini root partition, so to speak, and enough to get the kernel up and running so you can mount that initializing RAM device and process the rest of your hardware and modules to mount your real root device and get access to your init file to continue the boot process. So there is typically an init script on there that is run. It just does enough to load in the necessary hardware and to kick off the process and pass the control back over to the init script on your root partition. So that's one way that can be done. Or if it's a completely monolithic kernel, you can just, you know, has everything you need to. You don't need to use initializing RAM disk. It'll start up and go right for the init, define init application if you've defined something else, or just init on your root partition and begin the process there. Now, let's take a look at init for a second. I had mentioned Upstart. One of the differences between init and Upstart is that Upstart aims to be an event-based daemon that handles the functions init manages during the boot process and the shutdown process and during the operation of the system. One of the big differences is what they're working on is support for dbus, so that what the group behind Upstart has claimed is that their theory is that the process of managing devices has far exceeded the original capacity of init, in that devices are not just initialized at boot time anymore, but can be plugged in to the bus at any time. So even more, the number of devices, file systems, etc. that need to be supported has grown vastly over the years and shows no signs of slowing. So Upstart wants to resolve these issues and limitations or difficulties with the original use of init by providing an event-based daemon that hooks into dbus is one of their goals, so that you have more flexibility with it. I'll cover a little more of the peculiarities of Upstart and how it differs from init, but let's actually delve into init and see how this runs, how it works, how it coalesces and comes together. Now, most distributions today, your Debians, your Red Hats, your Mandrivas, your SUSEs, are what we call the System 5 style init system. But some, like Slackware and Arch Linux, are more of a BSD style init scripts. Now, Slackware in reality is a hybrid between System 5 and BSD, so I should probably be a little clear on what I mean between System 5 and BSD again. On a BSD system, what you have are a number of scripts that are run out of the etc/rc.d directory. But prior to that, what is initialized is a file called etc/rc, which is a system script that is run at the start and defines different variables and parameters and initializations for the system and kicks off a bunch of processes. Now, so what we have here is you have one script, initialization script, that runs, and then a number of scripts in the rc.d directory which are processed after the initialization script runs. This kind of differs from a System 5 system in that in a sys5 system you have defined run levels. Six run levels are defined by default, and you also have like the etc/rc file, you have a system initialization file that is called prior to executing the files in your run level. So let me clarify a little bit about run levels and what they are, okay? And in conjunction with the init tab, because I know I've kind of glossed over a little bit of how that actually is initialized and works in the init system, but I'll definitely cover it in just a few seconds, and it'll be all clear in a minute. So to get a better feel for how this actually comes together, let's take a look at the /etc/init tab file. And that is the configuration file for init and defines what init is going to process and how it's going to be processed and defines some variables. And the first thing that you'll notice is init tab generally defines a default run level. You will see a line in there that says ID colon to some number, maybe 2, 3 colon init default. Now what that is the definition of the default run level for your system. Now notice when I defined that, I said ID colon some number colon init default is what I had said there. There is a rhyme or reason to how init tab configuration file is, how entries are listed in there. You have 4 different sections on each entry, each separated by a colon. First off is an identifier of a unique identifier of 1 to 4 characters that identifies an entry in the init tab. Now these follow some kind of logic, of course. If you read through the init tab, I mean, you will note that there's a unique identifier for everything, 1 to 4 characters. You can add your own identification in here. There's nothing really set in stone for that, but just be aware that you don't want to replicate anything else in there. So in the example that we have here, in our first example for defining default run level, we use the identifier ID, followed by a colon. So that is the identifier. Next is the run level for which the specified action should be taken, or run levels. So it could be any number from 0 to 6, and you can have multiple numbers in there specified just right next to each other. 0, 1, 2, 3, or 2, 3, 4 defines it runs on levels 2, 3, 4, followed by another colon. So after you specify the run levels that it will operate on, then it's the action. It says what action should be taken. In our example here, it's a predefined init action, which is init default. It's setting the default run level. Okay? So it sets the default run level. And then, following that, it specifies what process to run. If it's going to be a certain process or what script to actually run. Okay, so what you have, again to reiterate, is an ID, the run level it's supposed to work and operate at, and then the action to be taken, and then the process to be executed, if there is one. Now, it's not only always guaranteed to have a process. If you omit the run level, that means it's going to be run at every level, so to speak. You know, by default, it will be run. For instance, we'll cover that in a second. The system initialization script is the first script to run, so it will be run at every defined run level. So system initialization doesn't necessarily need a definition for the run level. Okay. So again, we are processing the action init default, which is the entry that specifies the run level should be entered after system boot. So if none exists, you will be prompted for a run level at the console. Okay, so technically speaking, if you don't define a run level, you will be prompted. And there is no process to be run for this, okay? Basically, it's one of the few lines that kind of break the tradition of how the line, each line in init tab should be. So instead of specifying what run level it should be run at, it specifies what the default run level is going to be set at system boot. Okay, so following down from that, we have the initialization script for the system. Now, on a Debian-based system that I'm looking at right here, SI is the ID, followed by a colon with no run level specified. It means it's going to be used at boot. Followed by a colon, sysinit, which is the system initialization script. That's the action that is going to be performed, the system initialization. And then it says the process that's going to be run is /etc/init.d/rcs. Now that's going to run the script RCS in etc/init.d. Similar line in Slackware that's going to be processed, but instead of it being in the etc/init.d directory, in Slackware it's in the etc/rc.d/rc.s. So what you have in the etc/init.d, and if I look at the rc.s file, is a script that says execute rc. If I look in the rc, it is just a system initialization script that does things like mount root partitions, sets up the system with some variables, gets it basically ready for processing the run level that you want to operate at. Which is then what happens in the next series of lines. You have a handful of identifiers. In my Debian-based system, it's L0 through L6, which are defining run level 0 through 6. On Slackware, similar thing. It defines the run levels that I'm going to be operating at. It does a run level for multi-user. It specifies run levels 2, 3, 4, 5 to run a specific script. But it also has identifiers. So anyway, looking back on the Debian-based System 5 system, what it says is, for example, the default run level is 2. We are going to process at run level 2. We are going to wait until we are finished with run level 2 before continuing on. So it's L2 colon run level 2. This is the run level 2 colon wait, which means wait until we're done with this run level before we continue with the rest of the script, colon /etc/init.d/rc2. So what that does then is essentially it's going to say we're going to process the RC run level 2 scripts. Now this kicks off and it says after processing the RC at level run level 2, we're going to run through all the scripts in the etc/rc2.d directory. What that is, are a bunch of files in there that are symlinked back to the etc/init.d file. Symlinked and preceded with a K or an S and a number. And I talked about this, I think, in the first episode. S is for start, K is for kill. They go in numeric order. And what they do is they process each one of those. So if it's a start, an S is going to start a service. If it's a K, it's going to kill a service. And it's going to be processed in numerical and alphabetical order. Okay, so it's going to go through each one of those scripts and launch it. Now, what init is going to do is it's not going to continue the rest of the script until the run levels are processed. That is defined by the action wait. What the action wait says is the process will be started once the specified run level is entered, and init will wait for its termination. Okay, so we are entering into run level 2. We are not going to continue with the rest of the process until that script, that process of initializing run level 2 is completed. Same thing under Slackware. By definition, we're going through it's going to do the system initialization. We are going to go down to, depending on what run level we have defined, And for example, we are in by default run level 3 in Slackware. So it's going to go down once it processes the system initialization. The next file is going to run is rc:2345. That lists all the possible run levels. So we're at 3. So it's going to process this. It's going to wait and process the /etc/rc.d/rc.m, which is the multi-user script. And from there, it's going to process the rest of the initialization scripts in that RC directory. Once it's completed, it's going to pass control back to init to finish the rest of the script. Now, I know it was a little bit to take in. It's clearly defined in the init tab man page. It's pretty easy. Look over your init tab file and you maybe listen to this part again. It's pretty straightforward. Essentially, what we're doing is once we pass the initialization, system initialization, when we take our run level that we're defined at, and we are going to process the run level scripts. Let's take a step back a second, look at the different run levels that are available to us. As I said, there are 6 run levels in a System 5 system. Slackware uses a hybrid of System 5 and BSD, so it has 6 run levels defined too. Actually, sorry, my mistake, it's 7 run levels, not 6. 7. My dingus. Anyway, the way that they go is run levels 0 through 6. 0 is halt on all systems. It will stop the system. That's 0. Now, 1 is considered single user mode. It's kind of I mentioned single user mode when I said you can pass init equals bash instead of to run that into single user mode. You're going to get pretty much whatever's defined in run level 1 for your system, but most likely what a single user mode is going to be is a bash shell. Very minimal stuff loaded, no processes running, no network. You're going to be in as the root user. I think it might, some distributions nowadays ask you to log in as root. It's going to allow you, you shouldn't have your file system really mounted. It's going to allow you to do some repairs, fix some stuff that you might have screwed up. Something might have happened. It'll allow you to run file system checks. That's single user mode. Now, the rest of this, up until run level 6, the rest are kind of left up to the distribution to define how they want to run. 2, 3, 4, 5 are all left up to the distribution, so they will vary. Now, 2 through 5 on Debian-based systems are all considered multi-user. Okay, if you have X installed, you're going to get the graphical environment. XDM, X Display Manager, be it KDM, KD Display Manager, GDM, G Display Manager, X Display Manager, you're going to get the graphical login. If you don't have X installed, you're just going to be in multi-user mode. So on Debian-based systems, you are going to be in multi-user mode with a graphical login if you have X enabled. Slackware differs. Slackware is not going to give you XDM, GDM or KDM on run level 3. On run level 2. What run level 2 is on Slackware is unused, okay? So it's configured the same as run level 3. Run level 3, what Slackware is set at, is the default multi-user mode without X, okay? There is no X in Slackware's run level 3. You log into a bash prompt or your shell prompt. You have full networking. It's multi-user. You're good to go. On Red Hat-based systems, it might be similar. You might have multi-user mode in Red Hat on 3. You might have, and then X is defined on run level 5. SUSE Linux kind of does a multi-user mode on 3, and it depends. You'll have to use, I don't use Red Hat-based systems or RPM-based systems, so I'm not 100% sure as to where X is started, but you'll be able to figure out by using what I'm talking about here. Anyway, so we are at run level 3, which is multi-user mode. Same thing in Debian. On Slackware, run level 4 is multi-user with X11, so you're going to log in through GDM, KDM, or XDM session managers. On Debian, it's the same as run level 2, run level 3, run level 4, all the same. Run level 5 on Slackware is unused, but configured the same as run level 3. On Debian, again, it's configured the same as run level 2, so if you have X installed, you are going to have your display manager running with a graphical login. And then finally, run level 6 is a reboot. Okay. So you can specify at the boot prompt what run level you want to run at. It's not a good idea to set it to run level 0 or 6 because you're either going to boot into a stop or boot into a reboot. And that's kind of ridiculous why you'd want to do that. I don't know. But people do crazy things sometimes. Okay, so we covered what the run levels are. Following the definition of the run level, and once that's processed, your system initialization script is processed, your run level's processed. Now we get into some other things that can be defined by the /init tab file. And for instance, what to do with the three-finger salute, Control-Alt-Delete. So on Slackware, we got a little identification, CA, colon, nothing specified for run level, so that means at any run level, colon, CTRL-ALT-DEL, which is the action, Control-Alt-Delete, colon, and it defines what it's going to do. It's going to say run /sbin/shutdown/T for five, T for five, and -R for now. Actually, I kind of mangled that a little, didn't I? The -T stands for 5 seconds, and R stands for reboot, and it's going to do it now. So when you hit Control-Alt-Delete in Slackware, it's going to process the... It's going to immediately go into a shutdown mode, and it's going to reboot or initialize the reboot in 5 seconds. That's what it does. On the Debian system, same thing, but they have a T set for 1 and a -A, and the -A stands for use etc shutdown allowed to verify whether or not you're allowed to, if you have pre-configured shutdown restrictions that not anybody can do that. All right, other things that you can define in your etc directory or in a tab, etc directory in your init tab, are what to do when there's a power failure. For instance, on Slackware, it says due to gen power fail start. If power comes back on. Now, these are if you have a UPS system connected to your computer. Otherwise, it really wouldn't do you any good to try and define a general power failure option, what to do when the power fails. Because it's just going to shut your system off. No power, no system. That's the way it goes. Also, what is defined in the init tab directory in the file is your console logins when you're in multi-user mode. So in Slackware, we have a definition of C1 is the ID, colon, run levels 1, 2, 3, and 5, colon, respawn, colon, sbin a giddy, which is the giddy console, and it's set for serial device. Well, it passes the necessary parameters at 38,400 baud, TTY1, that's terminal 1, and it's called Linux. Set the style of the Linux. So it defines 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 terminal sessions, console sessions when it logged in. You can do other things like define serial lines. You could define dial-up lines if you want to. Anyway, similar thing under under Zandros or Debian-based system defines 6 console sessions. So that's going to be on... those are the sessions that when you hit Control-Alt-F1 through 6, change your sessions to different consoles. So if you actually screwed up your system... you can go into 1 through 6 and see what's going on or get into a console. X is generally on 7. Sometimes it's on 8 or above. But those console sessions are defined in the init tab. So give the init tab file a read, a man file, a read through. Also give init a read through for further explanation of things that you can do. You can actually put in little pauses if you want to in the process to say, hey, pause here, let me see what's going on in different parts in your init tab. I did that as an example when I did a presentation on the boot process to show people where we were in the process. So if you look at man init tab, That's INITTAB. It defines all the cool actions that you can do in here. Again, for instance, you'll notice that if you look at the terminals, the consoles that we were talking about, the Getty sessions, that they all had as an action respawn, which means that the process will respawn if it's terminated. So when you log into a console and you exit, you are exiting out of that console session. You're ending that console session. You're ending the terminal. It will respawn that Getty process again so that you can re-log back in. If it didn't respawn, you kind of be screwed. You wouldn't have a way to log back in once you used up all your console sessions. There's wait, which we talked about, which will be started once the specified run level is entered, and it will continue processing after that process is terminated. Once, which means that the process will be executed once when the specified run level is entered. Boot means that the process will be executed during system boot. The run levels field is ignored. And boot wait, the process will be executed during system boot while init waits for its termination. Kind of like wait is, but it will be processed only at boot. So there's a handful of different files in there, different control, specify controls, like I said. Power fail now. This process will be executed, and it is told that the battery of the external UPS is almost empty. So again, the power fail now is something that's related to UPSs, and most systems that don't have a UPS will neglect that. Anyway, you can get all this by reading the init tab file. Now, I had mentioned to you before that on a Ubuntu system that they have replaced init with upstart. And it's an upstart is an event-driven daemon. And you might be saying to yourself, well, what's the, you know, how does this look different than configuration for init itself? It doesn't use an init tab directory. Okay, so if you go into the etsy directory on Ubuntu, and you look at your look for an init tab, you will not find it in there. You will not find it at all. That's because it doesn't exist. We're not using init, people. And you might say, well Dan, I don't understand. Because if I do a ps-ef pipe at the head, I'll notice that my first process running is init. And I thought Ubuntu wasn't using init. Well, it is. Still runs init, but it uses upstart, which is a replacement for the traditional init. And it's not configured through an init tab file. You'd actually look into /etc/event.d. And in there are a bunch of different defense like events like run levels. And you notice when we were talking about configuring control alt delete. Okay. So if you actually look on control alt delete and upstart, if you look in there and you cat the file control delete, it says, well, start on control alt dash alt dash delete. And it says execute sbin shutdown dash r now control alt delete pressed. So it'll actually do exactly the same thing that init.d init tab file had defined. But in this, it's taking each process, breaking it out and defining it in its own little script. And it's processed by the upstart daemon when an event occurs. So as I said, look in the event.d file. You will see a lot of what will used to be an init tab broken down in individual files in there and individual scripts that get processed when an event occurs. Again, like I said, Control-Alt-Delete will process the Control-Alt-Delete file when it runs. You can define your own scripts in here. It runs similar syntax to init tab. What I recommend doing if you're interested in upstart, if you go to the upstart homepage, which is upstart.ubuntu.com, you can read up all about it. Maybe I'll do a separate HPR on that upstart myself at a later date. But anyway, that's pretty much the init script right there. Init. Once init is executed and finishes, you will be presented with a login prompt, be it at the console or through the X display manager of your choice. What we will probably go into next time is looking at some other technologies like Hotplug and UDEV and DBus and how those work when they're initialized, different daemons, how daemons are initialized in the system through the process of the run levels. We'll cover some of that, but today was in it. I hope you enjoyed it. Please contribute if you can to Hacker Public Radio. I thank you very much. Listen to TLLTS on Wednesday nights live or download our podcast later because I got to plug it sometimes. And thank you very much and have a great and happy day. Happy hacking.
Thank you for listening to Hacker Public Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.